This is an amazing story, and it is just the tip of the iceberg. We may have to have these gentlemen back on again, if they would be so kind, and continue this. You can read all of it in extraordinary detail in the book Selected by Extraterrestrials by William Mills Tompkins, edited by Dr. Bob Wood. Okay, Bob, right before the break, Bill said you wanted to name some names of some of these folks.
Well, yeah, I think one of the things that Bill has particularly important was the work that he did in 1952 to 1958, when he was working in a think tank at Douglas Aircraft. Right. At that time, he was working for two guys I personally knew and worked for. One of them was Wolfgang Klimper, whose name was Klimp. Another was Elmer Wheaton, who was the vice president. And they ran this think tank, and what they were doing was they were working on a Navy program for dealing with reverse engineering alien spaceships. And
which we had at that time acquired several of, I guess.
They were working with Bobby Ray Enman, for example, was a young guy who just assigned to help this team get on. And one of the things that really impressed me was that Bill has fortunately saved some of the documents that he had, one of which was an original drawing of a 2-kilometer-long spaceship that he personally drew.
A 2-kilometer-long spacecraft.
For the Navy, that he personally drew, dated 1954.
1954. This is amazing. This is about the time that Eisenhower was rumored to have had a meeting with one group, a very tall, thin group, at Edwards Air Force Base. There was a lot going on in the 50s, folks, and where there's smoke, there's fire. The idea of a 2-kilometer-long spacecraft in 1954 is mind-boggling. That suggests, of course, that we had to have had the ability to take people and material into space. This would be constructed in zero-G in space. It would have to be. You can't build something that big and blast it off from here without somebody seeing it.
Well, all I know for sure in 1954 is that there was a drawing. I don't know whether it was built or when it was built.
Yeah, I understand. But, I mean, if they built anything. Now, I want to say one other thing. For those of you who don't know, it's not the United States Air Force. It's the Navy that is in space. It's the Navy that has been behind all of this stuff.
Exactly.
You have to keep that in mind. ONI, something you'll hear on this program often, Office of Naval Intelligence. The United States Navy views space as another ocean. That's their territory. They basically own it. It's their proprietary medium. Okay. Anything else, Bill? And we'll go right back. Bob, we'll go back to Bill.
Well, there was one little thing I think Bill would want to cover, and that was the Battle of L.A., 1942, February 25th.
Yeah, I did want to make sure we got to that because it's. I've spent a lot of time on that on this program, published a lot of material about it on my site, talked to a woman who was an air raid warden in Culver City, got a call, and was told to get her hat on and get busy. And she said, well, what's the problem? And she was told to go outside and look up. And she did. And she saw it. It was right over her head.
Yeah, Bill did too.
Oh, please tell me, Bill. Battle of L.A., 1942. Extraterrestrials over Los Angeles. Most people were told it was Japanese, but it wasn't. Tell us what you know, Bill, what you saw.
No, actually, we were living in Long Beach at that time, and around 7 o'clock, my brother and I were reading the newspaper on the floor. My dad called us and told us to come out onto the deck. We were on the second floor of a very large house that was in broken up into four apartments. And so they had a big deck way up. And we couldn't, we were four blocks from the ocean, so we couldn't see the water, but we could see the area above it, and here was this bright light. And all three of us were looking at it. We called some of the neighbors, and he came out on their deck. We all looked at it. And while we were watching it for several minutes, a tiny beam came out of it and at about a 45-degree angle to the left and went down towards the ocean.
Uh-huh.
That beam then flipped up directly towards our apartment.
Huh.
Hit the back of the apartment, hit the trees, lit up everything around us, and went out.
Somebody knew you were watching. That's wild. That didn't just happen.
It was weird.
Yeah.
And
so, was this, Bill, excuse me, was this before or after the anti-aircraft had unloaded, was it 4,000 rounds or something at this object, or is this the second object? What do you think?
No, this was before.
Okay.
Because later in the evening, the anti-aircraft started firing.
Okay.
And incidentally, what has not been published is the number of U.S. Navy anti-aircraft guns. We had the whole fleet at that time, and they used up all of their 20-millimeter, 40-millimeter, and 5-inch guns.
Firing out of where were they anchored? L.A. Harbor?
No,
Long Beach?
They were in Long Beach Harbor.
And they were shooting at this? Wow. Nobody talks about that.
The Coast Artillery was firing at them. And, of course, searchlights, we had 8 searchlights on this one big one that came in and it parked. And it was there for over an hour.
Right, yeah.
Different ones came above it, came beside it, came underneath it. The searchlights would pull off of the big one and follow the smaller ones and try to shoot them down. And it continued, but finally it got boring, so we went back to bed around 3.
I have never heard this before. That's fascinating. Go ahead.
Our neighbors stayed the whole night, and they said that it really didn't stop till around almost 5 o'clock. But the next day, there was articles in the paper that they thought there had been some military aircraft coming in. It was just a cover-up.
Sure, of course.
But my dad was, like your friend, he was the guy that was responsible for that area. And, of course, he talked to everybody. And the interesting thing to me was that nobody got excited. Nobody got upset. There weren't any heart attacks. And while this was going on, over in London, Germany was bombing London. And those people were trying to get underneath the ground so they didn't get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And we have vehicles above us at less than 8,000 feet, most of them.
Right.
They were real high. And nobody was fast. All of them were slow. And many of them just parked.
Many of them what? Say that again, Bill. Many of them were...
Many of them just parked. They stopped, and
okay.
They parked there.
Wow.
And this is right in Long Beach.
This is astonishing, because we've only heard, Bob, you know this, the standard story on the Battle of L.A. was that there was one craft slowly meandering its way from the Culver City, Santa Monica Mountains area, all the way down to Long Beach before it, quote, disappeared.
There were two public releases. One of them was an unclassified one that said we fired 1,432 rounds of ammunition.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, there was a top secret release that said that they recovered one craft that had been shot down and crashed in San Bernardino Mountains, and the other craft was salvaged by the Navy at sea.
Okay, hold on. I've heard rumor that one went down by Long Beach offshore and went into the water, crashed.
Correct.
I've heard another rumor that something went down in, I think it was El Monte, and a truck, a big lowboy, a flatbed truck came in, and that may have been an American fighter that was up there and got hit by her own friendly fire. I don't know. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't know that case.
Okay.
I'm quoting from a top secret Majestic document.
Oh, my. Okay. So, two of these, you'd think that they'd know better than to park while they're getting shot at. But two were shot down, or one was damaged and it crashed in the ocean. The other went down the San Bernardino Mountains. The big one, we'll call that the mothership just for fun, moved off and apparently was undamaged. You can see the pictures of the Battle of Los Angeles, and you can see the exploding AA all around this thing and on it, and it was not, it wasn't damaging the big one. The
right.
smaller craft perhaps were scout craft, and they weren't so heavily able to withstand the bombardment. They now, what Bill just said is that the ships in Long Beach emptied their magazines. They had no more ammo to fire. So that would jack up the 1,700 round number to thousands.
Well, it would, and this was an Army report, so they probably didn't count the Navy rounds.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Fascinating. Okay, Bill.
It was interesting that there were several ships in the Navy dry docks in San Pedro.
Yes.
And they didn't even have most of their crews there, but the crews that were there grabbed their guns, they got their ammunition, and they're firing from ships that are in dry dock.
They're not even in the water. That's amazing.
They weren't even in the water.
That's wow.
I didn't know that.
Wow. Now, the were you, as a young man in 1942, you're in the Navy at that time, correct?
No, I was still in Vultee.
Okay,
this was only 2 months after the war started.
All right, that's right. Vultee. Okay, then you went in the Navy. Now, what, with your intuitive, unusual mind, what did you make of what you saw? A beam of light, a little pencil-thin beam of light, and it went down 45 degrees and then came right over to you. Now, that's strange. That's beyond coincidental. Something was
up. Yes, but I had that kind of a problem later on in the 60s working at Douglas.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that. All right. Anything else about the Battle of Los Angeles that you want to talk about? I think six people died. Traffic accident. Shrapnel coming down. There were a couple heart attack reports, but it's hard to know what's real and what isn't with something that big, because this is not many weeks after Pearl Harbor, folks, and the country was scared to death at the
right.
time. All right. Anything else you want to add to that, Bill? That's a wonderful story. But the beam of light coming over and landing on you and those around you and the building and lighting up the tree, that's mind-boggling. Wow.
But I've had a light problem later on, we can talk about later when you get a chance.
All right. All right. Well, that's an amazing thing. Okay. Vultee. Just to wrap up Vultee, what did you do at Vultee during the years you were there?
I was only there for several months.
Oh, and it was months, not years. Okay.
They had this gull wing, which is like an F4U-shaped wing, but it's a much larger airplane.
Oh.
And
I
had twin booms, and it was a Navy fighter. And Vultee had designed it, and they had a crash program to get it built and tested.
Uh-huh.
So they had me, like, walk around that for the whole 3 months and make suggestions.
So you actually watched this thing, and with your eye and your intuition, we'll call it, you were able to make suggestions on design and the implementation of aerodynamics and all of that.
Well, not the aerodynamics, but I sure did do a lot of stuff on the cockpit and where they were... The bomb shackles and the other things, which
okay.
I knew nothing about.
All right. Well, all right. So let's move back to 1942 and then beyond, when we knew the Germans had knowledge of at least two extraterrestrial races, the reptilians and the Nordics. And the Germans were allied, so to speak, with the reptilians. Now, people are going to say, well, if that's the case, why didn't they come up with one of their super weapons in time to affect the outcome of the war, at least appreciably? They were very, for those of you who don't know, they were very close to having ground-to-air missiles, which would have knocked down enormous numbers of bombers. Air-to-air missiles, they had rockets they were firing from their planes, but they weren't guided. They had the V-1, the V-2, and then they had the big one, which could hit New York, and they were ready to test that. They may have tested it. That was von Braun and his crew. There was a lot going on. What do you know about these spies and the reptilian information that they were gathering and how that was impacting the German weapons program?
Well, actually, the Germans knew they were going to lose the war.
They knew that by 42, yeah.
Yes, and so they had, because the reptilians have a massive cavern down in on Antarctica, and there's another one next to it.
A massive cavern?
Cavern underneath the ground.
Okay.
So the Germans then were, of course, taken down there in their meetings. They flew down in their UFOs.
So that's where the reptilians were hanging out in New Schwabenland. And that's what Admiral Byrd was sent down there with a task force in 1946 or 47, I forget. And he got, I guess he got his clock clean down there. They
kicked him out. That was terrible. We lost that one. That was the last of the war, and we really lost that.
So you know, from inside sources how bad we got defeated down there?
Well, yes, because they were taking the Navy, Admiral Rickabatta's operatives brought back schedules for different programs.
And okay.
Then they were finding in 42 that groups of different types of research were gone. So they would investigate what happened to that and where did it go. And they found out that the Germans were not building just regular submarines, but they built cargo transport submarines.
Yes, they were very large, yeah.
Very large. And so what they were doing is they were building these different classes of UFOs, which were anti-gravitational propelled, in hundreds of underground manufacturing facilities used to slave labor.
Yes.
So they started in 39 to take some of these facilities out of Germany down to Antarctica.
So they were actually this whole Germans in Antarctica story is shrouded in misinformation, disinformation, speculation. But you're here to tell us that it was real, and the ET reptilians were basically headquartered down there, but they imported Germans and their technology and their building programs down there and directed them, I guess, on how to build UFOs.
Well, actually, because they got down there way before the war was over, they were building these large 250-foot diameter UFOs with 30-man crews, and they flew to Mars. In fact, that flight was 1 week before Hitler was supposed to have been killed, and of course they didn't kill him.
We've done Harry Cooper, who runs an organization called Shark Hunters, was the first man to break the story 20 years ago that Hitler did not die in Berlin, that Bormann took he and Eva Braun out and moved them to Argentina, along with thousands of Germans, many of which we flew after the war to Argentina and DC-4 long-range transport, DC as in Douglas Commercial or Cargo. And we flew them down there. I knew someone who knew one of the pilots, and we transported them. And people said, well, why? Why did they let Hitler get away? Why did they let so many thousands, maybe tens of thousands, ultimately, of Germans go to Argentina? And the answer is technology. There was a trade. They traded that man's life and all the others for technology. German scientists, Kurt Debus, von Braun, and all the rest of them. That was the answer.
Yes, it was the answer. And that same trade type of thing is where Hitler traded the use of the population here in interbreeding and many other programs for information, just like you said. But they actually flew one of the 250-foot diameter UFOs to Mars, and it had problem on the landing, and all of them got killed.
Oh.
That flight took place 1 week before Hitler was supposed to have been taken out.
Oh, all right. The 250-foot craft departed from?
From Antarctica.
Okay. It was built there. I assume it would have been manned by both human and extraterrestrials.
No, it was all German.
It was all German?
Yes. Well, we had three Japanese fellows.
Okay. This is amazing. So down there today, right now, is there any of this still there? Do you know? Is that cavern still there? Was it sealed off? This is too big of an operation to make vanish. It would have had to have been blown up or something. What do you know about that? Anything?
Well, I would rather not speak about that.
Okay. You've just said a whole lot without saying a thing. Thank you for that. Wow. We have to pause, but I'm not going to pause. We're going to keep going here on this. So let's go ahead, Bill. What's next? For those of you listening, look up if you want. Look up Germans in Antarctica. Look up Operation High Jump, which was the name of a huge task force sent down there under the command of Admiral Byrd to neutralize this whole thing and find out what was going on. And they got their butts kicked bad. They limped home, and it was all covered up in the media. Oh, they returned, but they didn't find anything, blah, blah, blah. Not true. There's some film on the internet, Bill, allegedly showing some of the discs down there, the disc-shaped craft, firing on the ships and so forth. I don't know if it's legitimate, but it looks it. But that's just a little sidebar.
Yeah, well, actually, that did happen. We had several hundred airplanes in that battle group, and they shot every one of them down. The UFOs came out of the ocean and just took them out one right after another. And these were some of them, real large PV-2s, flying boats, twin-engine, four-engine.
The PBYs?
Yeah, PBYs and PB4Y2s.
And they just knocked all those down, and all the carrier-based planes, they shot them all down, all those
that
were launched.
The helicopter. They took every helicopter.
Wow. Wow. And where did you hear this, Bill? Can you? I don't want names, but what was your source?
I would really rather...
Okay, that's all right. I got it.
Bill was not in the Navy at that particular time.
I understand. I hope that Dr. Bob Wood, maybe I don't know if it's in the book, but I think Operation High Jump is certainly worthy of an extensive paper as to what Bill knows happened. It'll help fill in an awful lot of empty spaces. We were just told to get out of there, and we didn't. We went down there, and according to what we just heard, we were just destroyed. It was amazing they allowed our ships to return. I guess they wanted to, because if they had sunk all the ships, everybody would know something terrible was going on down there. So they let the ships go back. They knocked down all the fighter aircraft, helicopters, PBYs, and the others, and let the ships come back home. I think they sunk one ship. I don't remember, but
they sunk several ships.
Okay. Well, you get the picture, folks. That's wild. Now, I did ask William Tompkins, the book is selected by extraterrestrials, if anything was still going on down there, and he declined to answer. And I think all of you understand that we're not going to go any further with that. I think most of you understand the potential in the situation. So we'll leave it. This is a very smart audience. I thank you for sharing as much as you did. Bob, where do we go? Where would you like to go next with this story? You're the editor. Bill has an astonishing recall for detail. This is just an amazing story. Where do we go next, Bob?
Well, one of the things that Bill is particularly proud of was his influence on the Apollo program by personally meeting with Von Braun and Kurt DeBoos. He had some help from one of his Nordic secretaries in strategizing that particular visit. But the ideas that he presented were fundamentally sound. In other words, it's important to keep the vehicles in the vertical position instead of having them horizontally, as the Germans used to do. And he made that recommendation, having an L-shaped building.
Ah.
And that was adopted, actually, by NASA.
So that was Bill's idea to keep the launch vehicles vertical at all times.
I don't think I'm overstating it. Is that right, Bill? Would you say that's true?
Oh, absolutely. Because we had launched, Bob, you know, we had Nike Zeus missiles, and we had DM-18 missiles and all kinds of stuff, and we always had trouble when we've they're checked out great in the horizontal. We lift them vertical, and we have problems.
That's right.
For you listening, those were surface-to-air missiles, Nike Zeus and the Ajax, I think, was the other one.
The Ajax was first, and the Nike Hercules, and then the Nike Zeus was intended to intercept ballistic missiles from the Soviets.
Yeah, and that was from the Soviet Union. This is Cold War stuff now.
Right.
And what you just heard is when the rockets, they would all be stored horizontally, and then they would be raised 90 degrees to the vertical and launched if they needed to be. But there were troubles when they would raise them up. So Bill said, let's keep them up, and that's why they kept the Saturn V rocket and the others in a vertical position. And that's
exactly right. And he almost personally sold NASA on that concept.
Wow.
Actually, not without the approval of his management, which is part of the story that's interesting in the book. He did it single-handedly, and ultimately he got fired by inept management. But
okay, well, that's been the curse of many otherwise talented groups of people, inept management. This book stops at what point in Bill's career?
Well, when he was at TRW, we hit a couple of highlights at TRW, and of course one of the highlights is what he can say that he saw on the occasion of the landing on the moon.
Okay, now, this brings up, a lot of people listening are going to ask, why are we going with, we landed on the moon when we have so much evidence that Stanley Kubrick may well have been involved in filming the landing, the Van Allen radiation belts, other problems. Let me hear Bill tell us about the Apollo program and how he is certain that it did function as we are historically led to believe.
Okay,
why do you think it went there when a lot of people say it couldn't? And there was so much on the line that the government, our government, decided that they were going to film it here so we could broadcast the film just in case something didn't go right up there. We could not afford to be embarrassed and lose face to the Soviet Union. So what do you have to say to those folks, and tell us more?
Well, actually, that obviously is just a political part of the program that really doesn't make anything to do with the mission. First of all, the Apollo program was the result of the NOVA program. And the NOVAs are cone-shaped vertical ships, which are about 40 times the size of an Apollo.
40?
40.
Wow.
And so these NOVAs were then built for trucks to haul equipment up, because phase one of Apollo was to go to the moon, get up there, and then look around. Phase two was to build a 20,000-man naval base, as Bob says, on the moon, which is a research. It had all types of development of food, you name it, everything, not just a military base.
And
phase three was to go to all of the habitable planets in the solar system and or their moons and put naval stations on them.
Uh-huh.
And then the last phase was to go to the 12 closest stars and do the same thing on their planets.
Well, they sure as heck weren't going to do these with Saturn V rockets. This is the other technology. Now, let me ask you another obvious question. Was the Apollo program essentially misdirection to keep people from considering the fact that we were 100 years ahead in technology and had already been to Mars, even though it crashed in 1945? Was the Apollo program necessary? Was it a misdirection, like a lot of people feel the space shuttle program was?
Well, the space shuttle was only to try to cover up from everything that we got in trouble when we got to the moon. And, of course, when we got there, like Bob was saying, we had a program that we put together at TRW, and so we were able to tie into all of the missions from, in fact, it was like a small mission patrol, like the one in Houston. And I put that together real quick as a contractor at TRW.
You did. Okay, now, that mission control center was not controlling Saturn rockets or the space shuttle. You were controlling other craft, correct?
No, we were paralleling the missions. So, and again, the Navy was involved with this.
All right.
Because we had military missions besides just the public Apollo mission that newspapers got. What we were doing is we could tie in electrically and sound wise into the astronauts in the LEM, and we could hear everything they're saying.
Okay, so you were monitoring everything that was going on up there that the people down here might not have heard, that may have been off limits. What did the Apollo astronauts and which mission did they find that they were not alone up there?
Well, that was much earlier, because long before, 2 years before we sent the LEM up, we'd already photographed facilities on the other side of the moon. And so we knew that, but what we didn't know was that when we got there, that we were going to be told, go ahead and finish three or four more missions, pick up your rocks, take your pictures, and get the hell out, and don't come back.
Who told us that? Wait, which group?
Reptilians.
Okay, so the reptilians again. Yeah, I've heard that, and we do have some pretty substantial data that the astronauts up there were seeing large ships parked, watching them, and so forth. And
yes.
Those remarks were censored by Houston. They never made it out to the public.
Well, Bill has a sketch in his book that he drew of what he saw on that occasion.
All right, we got to take a break. We'll come back and pick this up in just a couple minutes. This just some of what you can find in this extraordinary book by William Tompkins. And stay tuned. We'll be right back. Okay, and welcome back. Dr. Robert Wood and William Tompkins, whose new book, Selected by Extraterrestrials, can be purchased right now. There's an Amazon buy link under his name in the guest section of my homepage. I hope you'll pick this up. And I want to remind you there are three more books to come. So, wow. And it's what Bill can't talk about that is... obviously of particular interest to me as a journalist and as a human being. But I get the picture, and I think I have a pretty good grasp of some things I was not quite sure about before, especially Operation High Jump. Okay, Bob Wood, where do we go? Now, I don't want to gloss over the Apollo program, and I shouldn't get into the Space Shuttle program because that was much later. I remember my dad coming back and telling me one time, he says, there's a big argument going on. Should we build the shuttle as a hybrid with, you know, a rocket boosting it into orbit, or build a space plane? And he said the Germans all wanted to build a space plane, but there was more money for the industry in building the hybrid. It was ultimately, you know, a disaster on one occasion, Tell us what you know about this, if anything, Bill, about the idea of the space shuttle program and a space plane program. They couldn't decide. They went with the cheaper version, basically.
Well, actually, let's go back again to Admiral Riccobonis people.
Now, you have to say that again. Which people?
The in the Navy, where I'm working for this Admiral Riccobonis, and he has these people who are essentially spies.
Yes.
They're Navy operatives.
Yes.
And they're going over there and bringing information back, and then... essentially, our office then is to disseminate that data to the top people in this country.
I got you.
All the top scientists.
Okay. All right.
So those fellas brought back at least 30 different types of vehicles. For instance, they built UFOs out of chromoly steel. They built UFOs out of wood. They built cigar-shaped vehicles. They built transports. They built construction vehicles.
Huh.
And so when you ask which of the two should be built, that really never came up because they were building everything that you could think of.
I got you. I got you. So that was kind of just a diversion, understood.
And so when it came to the Apollo program, it was obviously not using electromagnetic gravity, but then...
Right.
The NASA, which really is made up of SS people, as we know, and it's not a research university type of organization.
Uh-huh.
It's a military organization.
Oh, yes.
And it's for military missions.
That's what my dad used to tell me. He said, just remember this. Every single launch is basically military. They put some public stuff in there, science, to just keep people looking the other direction. But it's all, he said it's all military.
Yeah, a great deal of misinformation to the public.
Yeah.
But the point here is that the Germans had already done this, and this young lady, the blonde, she was continued to do it, and she then was shipped down to Antarctica, too, and she's still there.
And, still there right now?
Yes, and
she's much. She doesn't age. She doesn't age very fast, does she?
No, and she's an Nordic.
I was going to say she's not one of us. She's one of them. That answers that question.
Yeah, and so I want to just touch for a minute, if I could.
Yes.
On this, the two girls that we had in engineering.
Okay.
The Apollo program.
All right. Now, where were you? This is Santa Monica?
Okay. Yeah, I'm inside a secret think tank, which is inside of engineering.
Okay.
And this secret think tank is the company that's called RAND, R-A-N-D.
Yeah.
And RAND is, that means research and development.
Okay.
That's where that came from.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, RAND was started by the information that I took to Douglas.
From the Navy.
From the Navy. And then, almost 10 years later, I get hired in as a draftsman in engineering at Douglas.
Uh-huh.
My boss, the engineering section chief, reads my background, and he throws me into this secret think tank.
Yeah.
And here I am carrying out the requirements that had come from the Germans
amazing.
The Admiral Rickerbottom's operation. So this thing is so crazy.
Yeah.
It's wild.
And no,
so
that is.
Then in that secret think tank, I did larger versions of German transports. So I designed a 11-kilometer-long German transport, I mean, like a German transport, which would be used by the United States to take people off of the planet.
What was the propulsion? This is anti-grav, electro-grav, something?
Anti-gravitational.
All right. So we've had that since the 40s, basically. The
yes.
Germans had it first. All right. Now, what about these two blonde girls?
Okay. So one day in engineering, we were working on the Apollo program.
Uh-huh.
And one of my managers said that, did you see the girl over there in propulsion? And nobody can believe this. And there's this blonde girl that came in. And so I had already been going through three secretaries. And there's all kinds of problems with each one of them. And we ended up with all kinds of things happened to them. So one day then, of course, we were more like systems, and not just systems of RS-4B stage, which is the operating stage of the Apollo, but because we found so many mistakes in the Apollo program, we then turned ourselves in engineering in my section, because I was engineering section chief, into a systems study group of the vehicle and then the missions.
Oh.
So then I started doing missions too, which were naval missions.
Mm-hmm.
But then back to this day when this girl came in to my office, and she sat down facing me on my desk. And my assistant was with me. We were talking, just having coffee, and she just walks right in. And essentially, the first thing that comes in your head is she's some sort of New York corporate executive that's going to buy the whole company. Or maybe she already bought the company.
Uh-huh.
And that was the attitude.
Yeah.
And obviously, like what you've read before, the Nordic girls are absolutely gorgeous.
They're all tens.
Now,
yeah.
And so I'm married to a blonde Italian girl, okay?
Uh-huh.
And she is gorgeous. But this girl comes in and proceeds to tell me how she's going to redo everything on the program. And then she, still sitting on my table in a miniskirt, and she picks up my phone and she dials a number and she said, corporate business, you know, I need the phone. And that attitude continued for 4 years with this girl. She actually put stuff into my head, which were the answers to the most critical problems on the Apollo program.
She was shepherding you telepathically for 4 years.
Yes. And she was brilliant. Unbelievably brilliant.
Well,
and,
was she brilliant? Was she brilliant enough to get you in bed?
Never mind.
That's secret.
Actually, no. But there's all kind. You had to sit in there and just listen to her dialogue.
What? Well, did she have an accent at all, or did she speak just perfect English?
She's right out of Hollywood Boulevard. I mean, she was gorgeous.
I got it.
And,
well,
but she was extremely sexy. She never stopped. And she made you feel so good. It was an enjoyment just to be around her.
How fascinating.
But when you read the things that she did, it's staggering. And I'm not exaggerating. And much of what I did, I got from her.
Wow. Now, did she ever... I was being facetious about the bed thing, because I know you're a very happily married man for a long time, and you wouldn't do that. That's just, people didn't do that back then. Did she ever try to force herself on you in that respect?
Never did. But she talked to other people like we were, we were boyfriend, girlfriend.
So she was attached to you. I got it.
Yeah, and she's just a flirt, an absolute exquisite flirt. Unbelievable.
What a story.
Her uniform of the day, they came in, she and later on some other girls came in, and we started getting nothing but miniskirts. And it was a lot of fun.
Well, I'm sure. Well, it's always nice to have fun at work. Now, she clearly was a Nordic, correct?
Yes.
As you look back now. Yeah, there were two. And they don't seem to age like humans do. They maintain their looks. They're there. Did she ever say anything to you that was really unusual or suggestive of... Did she know that you knew she was a Nordic?
She always denied. They both did. They both denied that they were not. Okay, they always had excuses, and they had a father who was a banker over and so on, all which was all BS. But you're going to love some of the situations where we get into what you're talking about.
And, okay, all right.
You really have a ball.
It's in the book.
Yeah, this book is not only amazing, it's entertaining, too.
Well, it sounds like book of the year, story of the year, certainly. Selected by extraterrestrials, William Mills Tompkins, edited by Dr. Bob Wood. Would you gentlemen come back on the program very soon, and can we cover this book a little more?
Yeah, you should be able to get it in about 4 days. Sure, anytime. I'm here in town.
Well, we'll arrange it and have you both back. We'll do another 2-hour session. This is just amazing. Obviously, the book, whether or not people take it 100% as truth, is kind of beside the point. It's a fascinating story predicated on historical and scientific achievements right in the middle of them. And I don't know how you can lose. This you've got it all in this book. Your life has been just breathtaking. Bill, thank you very much for being here. We'll talk soon. I'll get you back on. And you take care of yourself.
Okay, I really appreciate you taking the time to look at it. I'm not kidding. You can have some fun reading the book.
I hope I did you right, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I sure did.
Very good.
All right. And Dr. Bob, great to have you back again.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Good night.
Good night. Yeah, good night. Have a good weekend.
You too. Okay. Wow. Well, so many things. We have to pause and come back for hour 3. So we will.